Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out the events page to see where Chad's speaking. Chad's speaking to some places. You know, he had to take a little time off in the cold winter. No one likes to travel in the snow, all that kind of stuff. I'm stuck in the snow. But soon and very soon, Chad's going to be back on the road, going to places maybe near you. So check out the events page. You can also register for the Here We Still Stand regional event over in Bentonville, Arkansas. That is the first weekend in May. There's still a couple of tickets left for that. So if you want to come, I recommend you grab those and come hang out with Chad and myself. All right, Chad, we are here in Job 16. We got through a little bit of Job's response. Job has told his friends that they are the most miserable of comforters, and truer words have maybe never been spoken. These are the worst kind of comforters that you could possibly have. And we ended with him making a pretty jarring statement, which is that God is not only against him, but pretty sure that God hates me. And we kind of ended talking a little bit about the sort of Old Testament binary of there is no God is neutral with you. God is either for you or against you. He either loves you or he hates you. He is certainly not indifferent. And this is how it went with all descriptions of sort of relationships and dispositions towards whether it's God or people. There's love and hate, and that's it. And Job says, well, as I audit my situation, what conclusion can I come to other than I'm pretty sure this God hates me?
Yeah, and he's going to transition in Job 16:10 to talk about how so that's kind of the vertical dimension, but you got the horizontal too, because now if God is against you, God's attacking you, Job says, then this has repercussions in this world too, because that means that everybody who thinks they're on God's side, well, they're going to start basically doing the same thing, thinking, oh, well, you know, obviously this guy's done something wrong. Look what God's done to him. Evidently, we should kind of imitate that as well and take him to task for what he's done. And that's what Job begins to say in verse 10. So after talking about how God's torment, his wrath, and gnashed his teeth at him, he says, men have gaped at me with their mouth. They have struck me insolently on the cheek. They mass themselves together against me. So gaping at me with their mouth, that's probably a kind of a like mock derision going on, is what I suspect. I don't know what English expression we'd use, since we don't talk about people gaping with their mouth, but that seems to be what's going on here. They're mocking him. They're opening their mouth in order to speak these kind of words. Now the striking instantly on the cheek, I don't know if he means that literally or if it's just kind of metaphorical for, you know, we talk about someone getting a tongue lashing. And of course, that's drawn from the physical, but it's actually describing a verbal attack. And I get a feeling anyway, that's what's going on here. I don't get the impression that people are walking up to Job and slapping him, but they are speaking evil against him. They are giving him tongue lashings. They are using words as weapons against him, and they mass themselves together against me, he says. So it's kind of almost a mob mentality. I mean, we see this happen all the time online, especially where kind of a mob will gather together and attack someone for, you know, whatever it might be. So this stuff is built into human nature. Now here, the ones who are massing themselves together and attacking Job, gaping at him with their mouth, they're probably these that see what's happening to him and think, well, obviously he sinned against God, and so he deserves it. And so we're going to kind of join in this chorus of accusers, just like his friends are.
Yeah, I think everyone's experienced being slapped across the face verbally online. That seems like something that probably most people have experienced. You read something, you're like, ouch, that's an insult right across the face there. I think what's fascinating is that as he says this, I mean, there's a lot of accusation here, I would think. I mean, who's listening to him say these words? Well, these three friends. And they are, I'm reminded of the Pharisees when Jesus will like tell a parable about, you know, maybe tent lending out a vineyard and people killing a bunch of people that he goes to that the man sends to check on the vineyard. And it has this great line where it says the Pharisees perceived that he was speaking about them. And you're like, right, very perceptive. I think these friends are probably doing the same thing here where they are perceiving like, who are you talking about here, Job? Who's gaping at you with their mouths and striking you on the cheek? And who's massed themselves together against you? We're the only ones here, so I'm assuming it's us. And I think that this comes like Job really brings it home in verse 11 when he says, God gives me up to the ungodly. I mean, who is he talking about? So this whole time, these friends have been trying to say, like, tell us about your ungodliness, Job. Tell us what's the ungodly behavior that you've been engaged in. What's the sin, Job? And Job won't do it because Job knows that if you're just talking about who's the better person, that he's as good, if not much better than these guys. And so Job levels this at them, which is God gives me up to the ungodly and casts me into the hand of the wicked.
Yeah, that's a nice, I guess nice is probably not the best adjective, but a nice contrast with what the psalmist says. Psalm 31:8 says, uses the same verb, you have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. That's what the psalmist says. And then Job says, God has handed me, he's given me up to the ungodly. So just the opposite. And yeah, I mean, it's he's looking at his friends, as he says, the ungodly, but he also is, looking up to the heavens, because he doesn't just say, I have fallen into the hands of the ungodly.
Yeah.
God has done this. Yeah, he's handed me over to the ungodly, cast me into the hands of the wicked. So for a couple of verses there, he shifted his attention more to the people around him and what he's suffering from them as far as verbal abuse. But he's going to shift right back to God in verse 12. And man, oh man, whew, these images that are coming up in 12 and 13 and 14, talk about rough. This is Job not holding back whatsoever. He says, I was at ease. I was at ease, kind of like, I suppose at peace is the idea. I was living a peaceful existence. Everything was good. I was at ease. And he, God, broke me apart. He seized me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. He set me up as his target. His archers surround me. He slashes open my kidneys and does not spare. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks me with breach upon breach. He runs upon me like a warrior. So it pretty hard to outdo that. I mean, Job is first of all saying, listen, I'm alone here. It's not like I got a pack of soldiers around me. I'm alone. And everything was good. I was at peace. I was at ease. And then all of a sudden God shows up. Not just God, but he's got like this army. Lord of hosts shows up here, got his archers with their quiver full of arrows and got the sharp knives, and they just go to work. He grabs me by the back of the neck. That's a typical, that expression occurs a few times in the scriptures. One is in Genesis 49:8. Judah, your brother, shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. This is the idea, you're chasing somebody down and you catch up with them and you grab them by the back of the neck. So Job says, what's happened to me? God grabbed me by the neck, threw me to the ground, broke me to pieces. And then, as if that wasn't bad enough, he made me into his archery target. His archers, so not his God, but his archers surround him, plug him with arrows, slice open his kidneys. And kidneys in the scriptures are, most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, are not just in reference to the organs themselves. I mean, you'll have that sometimes, like in the sacrificial descriptions in Leviticus, what you're supposed to do with the kidneys, the fat of the kidneys. But kidneys are typically a way of expressing the seat of emotions and affection in the Old Testament. So sometimes, a lot of times, your translations won't do this. They'll translate it as heart or mind, like you've tested my heart and my mind, or something like that. But in Hebrew, it's you've tested my like my kidneys. So they're the organ associated with emotions and affection. So when it says he slashed open my kidneys, yeah, I mean, this is kind of a, you know, bringing up physical pain, but it's also like I'm suffering emotionally. I'm suffering psychologically because of these divine attacks against me.
Yeah.
And then
in the Old Testament, the sort of the bowels is more the seat of the emotion than the heart.
Yeah. Heart's kind of your like main operating center. You know, you do feel with your heart, but you think with it, you reason with it. So, I mean, what we a lot of times would say your mind does, the Hebrews would say your heart does. So the heart's kind of your epicenter of your being. But yeah, you got sometimes your belly is described, or here your kidneys are described. But there's an old English expression about vent your spleen. And by that is meant to just kind of to state your troubles, to state your heartaches or your fears or whatever it is. And so, I mean, we still associate emotions with organs, but the Hebrew does that all the time.
Yeah,
quite the image here.
Yeah, it doesn't work as well nowadays.
No. If I say, man, I'm just going to vent my spleen, everyone's going to look at me like I've been reading Shakespeare too much something.
Go tell Stacy, Chad. Go tell her that you love her with both your kidneys. See if that works the same way as heart.
Yeah, but the only thing that, you know, we'll sometimes use, belly aching. We'll say, if someone's just grumbling, they're belly aching. Or of course, you know, all the time we'll use heart. He poured out his heart, or he's heartbroken, or he's got a hard heart. We use heart all the time, metaphorically, but not so much kidneys and spleen and other parts of the
I guess,
the
I guess
inward
unless we
body.
say something, unless we say something like gut punch, something like that, right? Like, so, and that's kind of what's going on here. I mean, is that, if you just read this, you're like, this is really graphic. And what it's supposed
that's
to,
brutal. Yeah.
Yeah, what it's supposed to explain to you is that Job is really, I mean, you're like, of course he's suffering, but it's more than that. Job feels not just like, oh, these boils are terrible and, you know, all my stuff's gone, but that God has not let up on him, right? And mm-hmm. that, like, I mean,
yeah.
so he's, he is everything that can be done to him that is terrible is being done.
Yeah. Yeah. Then he wraps up the section with saying, I have sewed sackcloth upon my skin and laid my, well, ESV has strength. Literally, it's horn. Laid my horn in the dust. Horn is a typical emblem of strength in the scriptures. You know, you lift up your horn, or the horns of the wicked are often used for the strong characteristics of the wicked as they attack. So laid my horn in the dust. So all my strength is gone. I've got sackcloth sewn to my skin, basically. My face is red with weeping. On my eyelids is deep darkness. Man, that's something we still see. You know, you see someone's eyes and they're all dark. You know, you know, they haven't slept, have been crying all night, or whatever it is. They're, you know, things are rough when on my eyelids is deep darkness. So that's the way he finishes the description of all of this. But then he closes it off, verse 17, with this. So keeping all of that in mind, you know, his body's full of arrows from God's archers. He's been sliced open. He's been thrust to the ground. He's got sackcloth and eyes are dark. Although, Job says, although there is no violence in my hands and my prayer is pure. So that's where he gets back to this protest. I mean, it'd be one thing if, yeah, he shook his fist at the heavens and said, come on, God, give me all you got. Or if he led a rebellious life and was basically asking for this, or was engaged in blasphemy or whatever. Job is saying once more, listen, there's no violence in my hands and my prayer is pure. What I'm saying to God is not from impure motives, or I'm not hiding some great sin in the closet of my heart that God is now taking me to task for. I'm innocent with regard to what I'm going through. There's a, you know, it just, it doesn't what I've done, I'm not saying I'm sinless, but what I've done does not match the horror that my life has become.
Yeah, well, to say that there's no violence in your hands and your prayer is pure, what has happened to Job is he's suffering the way that somebody who had committed great sins would suffer in his mind. Like this sort of punishment, if you were to look at it as payment, he's like, well, I have not went out and murdered people. I've done no violence to other people, yet it seems that violence is being done to me. And my prayer is pure is just another way of saying, nor have I like forsaken God or worshiped mm-hmm. other gods or become an idolater or anything like this. Right. So I've done no violence in your hand is I've done nothing to my neighbors. My prayer is pure is I've worshiped no other gods, not done anything to God. I've not done anything to anybody else. This seems pretty unjust.
But here I am. So he wraps up 18 through 22, wraps up this chapter by saying, O earth, cover not my blood, and let my cry find no resting place. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. My friends scorn me. My eye pours out tears to God, that he would argue the case of a man with God, as a son of man does with his neighbor. For when a few years have come, I shall go the way from which I shall not return. That starting that verse 18, O earth, cover not my blood, let my cry find no resting place. That's kind of a Genesis 4, Cain and Abel type stuff going on there. You know, when God says the voice of the blood of your brother is crying to me from the ground. So this occurs a few other places in the Old Testament too. It's this idea that, you know, when blood has been shed, that it doesn't matter. I mean, you can dig an 8-foot trench and cover it up, and it's still going to testify against you. That when innocent blood has been shed, that it has this witnessing power to cry out to God for him to do something. And so Job is here calling upon the earth, says, don't cover my blood. Just leave it there as a testimony for what's happening to me, and let my cry keep kind of resounding, finding no resting place, you know, bouncing, echoing back and forth until it's finally heard. And then in verse 19, I don't know quite what to make of this, but it sure seems to be Job is just found this piece of hope that he cries out here. Even now, he says, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. Which seems to suggest that Job believes he has a legal advocate in heaven, his witness. He's going to talk about this more in chapter 19, that famous "I know that my Redeemer lives" section. It's funny, you know, how he will go from what feels like the pits of despair to this cry of hope, you know, from God is attacking me and my blood's everywhere to, yet I believe I have a witness in heaven. Yet I believe that there is someone up there who is on my side.
Yeah, it's very strange. On one hand, God is tormenting me. He hates me. He's against me. He's causing all this suffering. And yet Job believes that, I must believe, that God is just, or else he wouldn't be appealing to him. And so in the midst of all that, yeah, you end up with this line that, hey, I don't want my blood to just soak up in the earth. I want to be visible. I want someone to maybe look down on the earth, see it. Knowing what I know or believing what I believe about God is that at some point he is going to observe this and say, there's a great injustice here, even though he has no one to hold responsible for this but God. He still believes, it's almost like he believes at some point, I don't want to say God's going to come to his senses, but like that at some point God's justice is going to overtake him, and he's going to be vindicated.
Yeah, it's kind of the idea that there will come a point where the God he's known in the past will act toward him in a way that he did in the past, instead of this strange foreign God or foreign feeling God who's now attacking him. And he wants, you know, verse 21, where he talks about arguing the case of a man with God as a son of man does with his neighbor. I think that's just part of the same kind of argument where Job wants to have a conversation with God as a man does with another man, or at least a day in court as we can with one another. But that's not happening. And he wants it to happen because he feels like he's going to die soon, verse 22. Because after a few years have passed, I'm going to go the way from which I shall not return. So while I'm still alive, let this happen. Let there be some sort of justice, some sort of vindication before it's too late. That's chapter 16. Now, chapter 17, Job continues as the introduction to the chapter says, "Where then is my hope?" So chapter 17 begins this way. And this is maybe even just kind of a continuation of the same line of talk that we saw at the end of 16. My spirit is broken. My days are extinct. The graveyard is ready for me. Surely there are mockers about me, and my eye dwells on their provocation. That man, that opening line is great. It's pretty hard to bring out in translation, but it's like you got three clauses in Hebrew, each with two words. It'd be something like, my spirit broken, my days extinguished, the grave for me. He's trying to capture in just as pithy a language as possible how bad things are. Broken spirit, days extinguished, and the grave is ready for him. And not only that, but he's got these mockers around him, and they're provoking him.
The graveyard is ready for me is pretty explicit, right? Okay, it's
That's a pretty powerful language there. Yeah, it's like the gates open, the grave's dug, the stone's in place.
yeah, just wait,
All that
just waiting.
remains is the body,
Yes.
just waiting for Job to show up. Verse 3, lay down a pledge for me with you. Who is there who will put up security for me? Since you have closed their hearts to understanding, therefore you will not let them triumph. He who informs against his friends to get a share of their property, the eyes of his children will fail. That's some kind of some strange stuff going on here. I think what's happening is this. So verse 3, when it says, lay down a pledge for me with you, or who is there who will put up security with me, seems to be Job saying, is there anybody who's going to be on my side? Is there anyone who's gonna put up security for me or make a pledge for me? Because I'm all alone, and it would be nice if I had someone who was around me. And this whole thing, beginning with verse 2, is set up kind of as an oath. You can't really bring this out in translation, but that surely, where it says, surely there are mockers about me. In Hebrew, that's the way the word that they translate as surely is the way you begin the solemn oath. So this is like Job making an oath to God. And I think he's talking about his friends here, the mockers, those who are provoking him. And then when he says, since he's talking to God here, you have closed their heart to understanding, therefore you will not let them triumph. I think that's him talking directly to God about what God has done to them, that they can't get it. They don't get it. They can't understand because God has actively closed off their heart so they can't understand what's going on. And that's the reason they speak such false accusations to Job.
Yeah, this is quite the accusation in verse 5 too. I mean, he who informs against his friends to get a share of their property, the eyes of his children will fail. I mean, is it you have to assume here that Job is talking to about his friends. I mean, and the fact that he says this right in their presence, that now I don't know exactly how this works, but this sort of informs against them is, I would assume, this sort of accusation that he has some sin. They're trying to expose some sin in Job. But this part where it's like to get a share of his property is quite interesting. So Job, I guess, still owns a bunch of land and stuff, but is he are these friends trying to make sure they're in the will? Are they I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah, I don't know either. But it sure sounds like that might be a possibility. That there's more than one motive for why they're doing what they're doing. So he transitions into verse 6 saying, he, that is God. He's made me a byword of the peoples, and I'm one before whom men spit. My eye has grown dim from vexation, and all my members are like a shadow. Let's kind of continue more of this description of his suffering. You know, people are making fun of jokes about him. I am one before whom men spit. I mean, we still kind of have, not often, but there is this idea, you know, spit in somebody's face or spit in somebody's presence. It's a physical way of showing contempt or hatred or derision or whatever it might be. And his eyes are dim, his members are like a shadow, continuing this kind of physical description. Now in verse 8, he refers to verse 8 and 9, he refers to a group of people that he calls by three different names: the upright and the innocent and the righteous. Probably he would lump his friends in this category, but probably others too. And what seems to be communicated here is these people are attacking Job for the same reason we saw earlier, because they think that God is against him. So the upright are appalled at this. The innocent stirs himself up against the godless. Yet the righteous holds to his way, and he who has clean hands grows stronger and stronger. I checked the commentaries on this. There are a lot of different ways that people take this. The way I'm reading it is that Job is somewhat sarcastically referring to the upright, the innocent, and the righteous as those who are stirring themselves up against him, the quote-unquote godless one. And the idea, at least the way I'm reading this, would be that they consider Job to be godless. They consider him to be a sinner, and therefore they consider themselves to be on God's side, and therefore feel justified in claiming their own clean hands and pointing guilty fingers at Job, whom they consider to be unclean.
Yeah, I think that's right. I one of the things that's sort of you have a contrast in, you know, him saying that his eyes have grown dim from vexation and all his members are like a shadow. This is like he's sort of withering away. But then he says, you know, just one verse, and he says this thing about the upright are appalled. And this, but then in verse 9, he says, yet the righteous holds to his way, and he who has clean hands grows stronger and stronger. And so like, there's this weird contrast between him saying, hey, my eyes are about to give out. I've withered away into nothing. But yet, the righteous grows stronger and stronger, and I think there that sort of stronger and stronger has to do with holding to your way, right? So you become more and more resolved, right? So even though your body is, you know, just withering away to nothing, your resolve for your cause is not following the way of your body.
Yeah. So he goes on, verse 10, but you come on again, all of you, and I shall not find a wise man among you. Job is not giving up. He's,
listen to that resolve.
You got to give it to him. I mean, come on, give me all you got. He's not gonna stop. I shall not find a wise man among you. My days are past. My plans are broken off. The desires of my heart, they make night into day. The light, they say, is near to the darkness. If I hope for Sheol as my house, if I make my bed in darkness, if I say to the pit, you are my father, and to the worm, my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who will see my hope? Will it go down to the bars of Sheol? Shall we descend together into the dust? So he's saying, basically, I'm nearing the end. At least it feels like I'm nearing the end. His days are past. His plans are broken off. His desires of his heart have passed away. And he's dealing with people in verse 12 who turn everything backwards. They make night into day, and they say the darkness is near to the light. I'm assuming this is a metaphorical description of how his friends are turning everything upside down. But then he starts in this kind of downward trajectory towards Sheol, saying, you know, if Sheol becomes my address, if I'm going to make darkness my bed and claim the pit and the worm as my family, where then is my hope going to be? And who will see my hope? This is Job basically saying, if if I go down there, if I go down to the pit, if I go down to the shoal, then all hope is lost. So let something happen before we get to that point, before that graveyard that is ready for me has claimed me. Let God do something to reverse this situation before it's too late.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise he's saying me and Hope are gonna go live in the dust together, right? I mean, the idea of Hope is not to like take it into the grave with you, right? Now,
You're
as
right.
Christians, of course, we do this, right? This is exactly what we do. We buried with our hope, but Job is not in that place. Job is in a place where he's like, okay, I'm looking for vindication here, and what am I going to do? What am I? I'm just going to be buried with this hope. Me and Hope going to be lying in the grave together.
There's so many situations like this where you now knowing what we know, you wish you could go back and say kind of sit down beside Job and say, "Hey, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying, but let me let you know what's going to happen. You know, this hope that you're talking about being buried with you in the grave. I got some great news for you, actually. That's precisely what is going to happen. Yeah, because this Redeemer that you're going to talk about." In chapter 19, he actually came, and he took hope into the grave with him, and he came out again, so that he gives us hope every time that we put our loved one in the grave or think about putting ourselves in the grave eventually. Hope will not stay buried, but it'll bring us forth in resurrection. It's just you wish you could go to Job and say, "Hey, I got some great news for you." I mean, that's what he needed his friends for. They weren't giving it to him, so. Part of me wishes, man, I wish I could communicate this to Job and give him the hope that we have this side of the resurrection of the Messiah.
Well, yeah, because I mean, hope, what Jesus says about himself, right? That he must go be planted like a seed. And this is how ultimate hope is, right? Like ultimately hope goes into the grave. Ultimately hope is put into earth and then comes bursting forth. That's how it works, you know? So yes, hope died, the way that every seed that's planted dies and then something springs forth. And so, yeah, Job says a lot of things like that. Yeah, you certainly are like, oh man, that actually, I know it doesn't seem like that's how it works, Job, but that is how it works.
We've seen several occasions where it's like Job says more than he realizes, or God is in letting him speak words that are actually prophetic in nature, even though they just come across as nothing more than sad lament. There's actually a lot of truth and a lot of hope in his words, which is, I mean, one of the great things about the fact that this book was preserved for us. You know, there we can read more out of this book than Job even realized that he was saying, and we can do that in light of the resurrection.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I guess we need to get to Bildad. Bildad is a blowhard. I don't even have a nicer way to explain exactly what he is. So this is going to be his response, chapter 18. Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, "How long will you hunt for words?" That could also be translated, "How long will you make an end of words?" The Hebrew there is debated. It's ambiguous, but your different translations will put different things there. But how long will you hunt for your words or put an end to words? Consider, and then we will speak. I'm just going to kind of skip over. There's a lot of controversy around that verse that we're not going to get into the weeds about, but just some difficult Hebrew there to translate it. Some people think that Bildad's speaking to his two friends. Some people think that he's speaking to Job. But kind of leaving that aside and jumping to verse 3, this is where he definitely begins to speak to Job. "Why are we counted as cattle?" Which I just love. Like, why are you treating us like stupid cows, Job? Are we like this dumb beast here? And you want to say, well, you know, if the shoe fits. "Why are we counted as cattle? Why are we stupid in your sight?" I don't know, Bildad, maybe because you are, maybe because you're saying a lot of stupid, beastly things. Maybe that's why Job is saying what he is. And then he hits below the belt on this one. So earlier, Job had said, to God, about God rather, he has torn me in his wrath. That's in chapter 16, verse 9. Job said, he has torn me in his wrath. Now Bildad, using the same expression, turns around and says, you tear yourself in your anger. So he's like, well, this isn't a God problem with you, Job. This is a you problem. You're tearing yourself up. You're the source of all of these problems that you're having. You're tearing yourself up in your own anger. God's not in anger tearing you up. And then he goes on, verse 4, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or the rock be removed out of its place? By which I think he's communicating, you know, are we going to like just alter the fundamental orders of creation just to satisfy your protest, Job? Are we going to like, you know, forsake the earth and make rocks be moved around just to fit with the way that you think things ought to be? We're going to restructure the whole universe in order to make it align with what you think the way should be, Job?
Well, I think part of what is happening here is that, because you see in verse 5, he gets back to this same tired argument that they keep going back to over and over again, which is, indeed, the light of the wicked is put out, and the flame of its fire does not shine. Like this whole thing of like, well, you know, this is the sort of thing that happens to the wicked. This is their fate, Job, which is, we've heard over and over and over again. And it seems like maybe one of the things that he's saying when he says like, well, are we just going to restructure everything? It's like, we're going to reconsider everything we believe about good things happening to good people and bad things happening to bad people, Job. Is that what we're supposed to believe? Just because you're the one guy suffering, now we have to believe that sometimes the righteous suffer. We're not going to do that. And let me make this argument again now, Job. This is how it goes. The light of the wicked is put out.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. From verse 5 to the end of the chapter, verse 21, he just basically repeats the same old worn out, shallow, not wisdom, foolishness, really, that he's been spouting and his friends have been spouting this entire time. The light is dark in his tent. His lamp above him is put out. His strong steps are shortened. His own schemes throw him down. He's cast into a net with his own feet. By the way, Bildad must have a copy of the thesaurus, because he like looks up trap and then finds all the words that are synonyms of trap. He's got net, mesh, trap, snare, rope, trap. All those are different Hebrew words to describe traps into which someone can be caught. So he walks on its mesh. A trap seizes him by the heel. A snare lays hold of him. A rope is hidden for him in the ground. A trap for him in the path. So he's, you know, basically saying, you know, if you're wicked, like you are, Job, you're going to get caught. Terrors frighten him on every side, chase him in his heels. His strength is famished. His calamity is ready for his stumbling. So this whole chapter, I mean, I hesitate to even read the entire thing, because all it does is it's just rhetorical heaping up of words, all of which communicate the same thing. You know, whether it's you're going to die, you're going to suffer, your roots are going to dry up, you're going to be thrust into the darkness, you're not going to have any posterity, blah, 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 blah. It's nothing more than him saying what he has said all along, just in more images and more metaphors that, hey, Job, what's happening to you is what happens. You know, you play with fire, you're going to get burned, and you've been burned. So let's confess that fire so we can tell what's really going on here.
Yeah, and we're not going to reconsider this ordering of the universe. Like, we are not going to look at you and then decide that we have to change the way we think about all these things. And it sort of ends, like, I mean, in verse 21, I mean, he just tells them straight out, right? Surely such are the dwellings of the unrighteous. Such is the place of him who knows not God. Right? So he's like,
yeah.
No. Like, we like, no, dude, this is what a godless dude like you has coming.
And this is what theological arrogance sounds like when someone is trapped in this this cause and effect mentality, where if a bad thing happens to you, it's because you've sinned. And they're, yeah, it ultimately they say, well, you're wrong because you don't even know God. You know, if you knew God like I do, you'd realize this bad thing is happening to you because of what you've done. So it's a, yeah. Unfortunately for Job, he doesn't have a good theologian there. He doesn't have a God. He needs a preacher. He doesn't need a a law addicted friend like he has here. He needs a preacher to come along and preach some good news to him, and to point out the fact that yeah, the righteous do suffer, but turns out the righteous one also suffered, in order that he might give us hope and resurrection and light in the midst of these dark days. That's what I'd preach to Job. That's what he preached to us, but he doesn't have a preacher, so he's going to have to deal with his friends for now.
Yeah, and that's it, man. We are out of time, but next episode we will get into probably the most famous of Job lines, where Job is gonna start to put something together right here that we've been quoting ever since he said it. So I'll see you next week, Chad.
All right, we'll see you then.